This series of six lectures, Capital, the Productive Process, and the Rate of Profit, was delivered in August of 1989 at the Jefferson School's fourth summer conference, The Intellectual Foundations of a Free Society IV, held on the campus of the University of California at San Diego. In following these lectures, it will be helpful to have available the two lecture supplements, which are referred to from time to time in the lectures. If you are listening to this series as part of my full program, the supplements can be found on the CD labeled Lecture Supplements. They have the same name as the lecture series. If you did not purchase the full program, the supplements should have been sent to you either on a disk or as email attachment files. Please print out the supplements. The material in this lecture series is elaborated upon in chapters 15 through 17 of my book, Capitalism. Well, good morning, everyone. I hope that you all followed Diane Lamont's advice and brought along the lecture supplement. And I urge you to bring it for all of my lectures, because frankly, otherwise, you will simply be lost. If you don't have a copy, try to sit next to someone who does, please. Let me begin with the description of the lectures, of my lectures that appeared in the set of lecture descriptions and faculty biographies that everyone has received now and when you first enrolled. I ask a series of questions. I'll attempt to give an answer to most of those questions immediately, so you'll know without doubt where I stand. And then as we proceed, I'll attempt to validate those answers. All right, I ask the following questions. What determines the average rate of profit in the economic system? That's the one question I will not attempt to answer at this moment. Do technological progress and improvements in business efficiency raise the average rate of profit? No, they do not. Or, on the contrary, do they lower it by enlarging the supply of goods and thereby causing falling prices and alleged deflation? No, they do not lower the rate of profit, nor does technological progress. Do saving and capital accumulation imply a falling rate of profit? No, they do not. Does additional saving place business in the contradictory position of having more money available to invest at the very time its sales revenues are reduced because the consumers are saving instead of spending? No, business is not placed in any contradictory position. Can there be such a thing as too much of an increase in production or too much saving? Again, no, both times. And I will attempt to prove why not as we proceed. Well, in order to deal with the kinds of questions to which I've just supplied answers, it's necessary to adopt some epistemological procedures. And this is why I've decided to begin with what I describe as a methodological epistemological introduction. If you think about the nature of the economic world, there are hundreds of millions, probably billions, of participants in the economic system worldwide. They're producing tens of thousands of commodities, and the volume of exchanges comes to the trillions. It is simply impossible to try to deal with that kind of immensity on the perceptual level. In order to make the economic world intellectually manageable, we have to devise what von Mises has called imaginary constructions, which I call simplifying conceptual constructions. These represent a kind of telescope, an intellectual telescope, with the aid of which we can actually perceive the economic world. Elements of such simplifying constructions would be the assumption that I made in the fall TJS seminar, that all capital goods are used up entirely in just 1 year, while in reality, of course, it may be as long as 50 years. This represents a great simplification. Later, in some of my later lectures in this series, I'll make the assumption that all the buying and selling that go on in the entire economic system for a whole year are concentrated in a single day. That will make it much easier to think about things. Well, these simplifying conceptual constructions, I think, are perfectly valid if they retain all of the essential features of the real world that we want to understand, and merely present those essentials in the most simplified form possible so that we're in a position to grasp their mutual relationships. And I think this approach is fully in accordance with the remarks that Ayn Rand made in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, that all knowledge is processed knowledge. Theoretical knowledge is the most highly processed form of knowledge. And simplifying conceptual constructions are an essential aspect of that processing. Now, a critical second methodological, epistemological element is making the basic assumption, which will be repeatedly relaxed, but our provisional starting point at all times, will be an assumption that I call invariable money. This means the assumption that in the entire economic system there is some fixed, definite quantity of money, and that this definite quantity of money supports only a limited, definite total volume of spending in the whole economy. This may sound a little involved to you, but everyone here, I think, has read economics in one lesson, and I think that assumption is implicit in economics in one lesson. If you think back to the very first chapter, The Broken Window, a hoodlum breaks a window, and now the baker will have to buy a replacement. And Hazlitt analyzes the consequences by pointing out the baker would otherwise have bought a suit. Now there's that much less spending to buy a suit. There's that much more to buy a window. Well, implicitly, Hazlitt is assuming that there is a fixed total amount of spending in the whole system. And I think that's a perfectly sound procedure. And ever since I read economics in one lesson, I've adopted that procedure in all of my thinking about economic problems. Now, we will not ignore the fact that the quantity of money changes, almost always it increases, but we'll make that a separate analysis. First, we try to understand what would happen if everything is going on with no change in the quantity of money or volume of spending. And once we understand that, then we develop what will happen when there is a change in the quantity of money and spending is increasing. And then we put together these two separate elements of the analysis. And that will give us a much more complete description of the actual world. And this is the procedure of physics, for example. When a physicist or engineer describes the motion of a boat, they're considering first what is the velocity provided by the engine. Then they're dealing separately with what is the effect of the current or the wind. This is the nature of analysis, to deal with one thing at a time. And holding money constant is the essential element that we want to put on the side. We want to look at how things work in under a fixed quantity of money and fixed volume of spending. That will be very important. Now, a third element, which I want to give the greatest stress to, is the fact that in all of our reasoning, in economics especially, or everywhere, but economics is most in need of being reminded of this, we have to adhere rigorously to an Aristotelian concept of entities. Now, I will try to show that an Aristotelian concept of entities, by which I think you all understand, each thing is simply what it is. A is A. That's all it is. It is nothing more. You might wonder who could dispute this. How is it controversial? There are philosophers who say, well, this is so self-evident, it doesn't even need to be stated. What else could A be but A? Well, we are going to see what many, many people believe A can be beyond A. And I think the prevailing formula in contemporary economics, much above all in contemporary professional economics, but also to an enormously high degree among the people on the street, is an alternative logical formula that A is A plus. A thing is more than itself. Now, I'll give you an example. In economics, when I think that A is A, I mean, for instance, a loaf of bread is a loaf of bread. And that's all it is just a loaf of bread. A loaf of bread is not simultaneously a loaf of bread plus the flour from which it was made plus the wheat from which the flour was made. Yet that latter description is the description you'll find in all contemporary economics textbooks. And it is believed in one form or another by the great majority of people on the street. In one form or another, the great majority of people believe that when you buy a loaf of bread, in some sense you're buying more than the loaf of bread. You're paying for the flour and the wheat. You're paying the wages of the bakers and millers, and on and on. Well, I adhere to the proposition that the loaf of bread is simply and only a loaf of bread. Now, we want to explore, first of all, today, the questions, what do you produce when you produce it? What do you buy when you buy it? These are the two leading questions I want to begin with, and their significance will be enormous for the question of what is the role of consumer spending in the economic system versus what is the role of saving and productive spending, buying for the sake of subsequently selling. Consumer spending versus business spending. Contemporary economics is entirely consumer spending oriented. The economics that I propound places the emphasis on business and the spending that business does, which is based on a foundation of saving. And this radical difference depends entirely on which view of entities we're applying. The Aristotelian view of entities, in my judgment, implies that most spending in the economic system depends on saving. The alternative view of contemporary economics implies that it depends on consumption. Now, at the bottom of page 2, I have a simple table titled What is Produced in a Year? And we have 4 years just to develop the process. We've got 3 items: bushels of wheat, sacks of flour, loaves of bread. Now, if you ask me, what is produced, for example, in year 3? Well, my answer is the total of production in year 3 is x sub 3 bushels of wheat, y sub 2 sacks of flour, z sub 1 loaves of bread. That is my conception of the gross product of year 3. Now, much of production, probably the great bulk of production, is used up in the course of further production. Most production is productively consumed. For example, wheat, after it's produced, is productively consumed in the making of flour. Flour, after it's produced, is productively consumed in the making of bread. The total of production is the wheat, the flour, and the bread. The wheat and the flour are productively consumed in further production. Now, the gain from production, the total of production is the gross product. The wheat, the flour, and the bread combined represent the gross product. If we subtract from the gross product what is productively consumed, what's used up in further production, then, on my conception, we arrive at the net product. So if we subtract from the sum of wheat, flour, and bread, the wheat and the flour that are used up, the net product will work out to be the bread. Well, in contemporary economics, there is an enormous confusion between the net and the gross product. Contemporary economics does not recognize what I call the gross product. In fact, when I state the gross product as the sum of wheat, flour, and bread, Practically every contemporary economist would accuse me of making a profound error that every freshman is warned against. What is my alleged error? I know there are many students of economics here. Yes? Yes?
Double counting?
I'm double counting. I'm allegedly double counting when I say that the total product of the economy is the wheat, the flour, and the bread. What is supposed to be the total product? Yes?
Bread.
The bread. Only the bread is the total product, and the bread supposedly counts the wheat and the flour. When you say bread, you are counting not only the bread, but the wheat and the flour. And thus, if you say the total product is the bread plus the wheat and the flour, you're allegedly double counting. You're saying more is produced than is in fact produced. Well, I've learned that there are others who double count too. For example, the Statistical Abstract of the United States, as I point out in the excerpt from my book that I've distributed, you'll find on the same page a statement of what is the production of finished steel and raw steel. And both were produced. And of course, you could look in various sources and you'd find there are figures for the wheat that's produced, the flour, and the bread. All of these, in fact, are produced. And in the view of contemporary economics, it's an error to say that. Now, how does contemporary economics get into this position, and what are its further implications? Contemporary economics has a peculiar view of what you produce when you produce it. My view is that a baking company produces bread. The product of a bakery is a loaf of bread. The product of the miller is flour. The product of the wheat farmer is wheat. Contemporary economics has a different view. It says the product of the baker is not bread, it is bread minus flour. It's the difference between what you produce and what you use up in producing it. It's the product addition. The product of the miller is not flour, it's flour minus wheat. Now, if you have any trouble in accepting that, maybe some of you will think that sounds reasonable, let me quote you a passage from a prominent economics textbook by Professor Lloyd G. Reynolds of Yale University. He writes, "A farmer produces $100 worth of wheat, which is sold to a flour miller. The milling company, by adding labor and capital inputs to this raw material, produces flour, which it sells for $150. A baking company uses this flour to produce $225 worth of food." Now he goes on, "How much has the milling company produced?" Now he just told us a moment ago that the milling company produced flour, which it sold for $150. My answer is, the milling company produces flour worth $150. But Professor Reynolds answers, not its sales revenues of $150, since $100 of this was really produced by the farmer. The milling company's output is the sales value of its product minus its purchases from the preceding stage of production. We call this the value added at the milling stage, which in this example is $50. Now, if the milling company's output is flour, as I think it is, the value of its output is $150. But if you think that its output is not flour, but the abstraction flour minus wheat, then the value of its product is $50. So I just want you to realize that when I say contemporary economics claims that what is produced is not the product, but the difference between the product and what you use up to produce it, that is really what they're saying. Now, on that view, confusion develops over who produces what. Normally, a bakery believes that it produces bread. But in the view of contemporary economics, the bakery is not producing bread, it's producing bread minus flour. Well, who's producing the rest of the bread? The flour millers and the wheat farmers. They're producing the bread that the baking company mistakenly believes it's producing. Now, on the basis of this view that what you produce is not your product, but the product addition, the net product, contemporary economics reaches the conclusion that the total product, the sum of all production, is the final product, the so-called final product, which in essence is consumer goods. And I illustrate this on page 3, following my table 1. Let's trace things out over a 3-year period. We start, we have X1 bushels of wheat produced in year 1. All right, that's the product of the wheat farmer. We'll assume he doesn't use up anything. We don't want an infinite regress. We'll let the wheat farmer produce X1 bushels of wheat. But now, what is the flour miller supposed to produce in year 2 when he uses up the X1 bushels of wheat? He produces Y1 minus X1. And what does the baker produce? He produces Z1 minus Y1. Now, if we add up the 3 together, if we add up the farmer, the miller, and the baker, as I do on page 3, and we have X1, that's the output of the farmer, Y1 minus X1 is the output of the miller, allegedly, Z1 minus Y1 is the output of the baker, what's the total output? Just Z1. All production that is used up in further production becomes obliterated from production. If your view of production is that it's what you add rather than the entity you produce, then all the production of the economy that is used up in further production ends up not counted in production. It's obliterated. In the view of contemporary economics, the total of production is this final product, the bread. Now, this viewing of production as the product added at each stage, this supports a further confusion. It supports the confusion that the final product, the bread, is the total product, not merely in the sense of these peculiar product additions, but that the final product is the total product in the sense of actual physical entities. It supports the notion that somehow the bread is the bread, the flour, and the wheat. Now let's see how this is done. If you look at page 3, if you hold this notion that what a producer produces is his product difference, what he produces is his product minus what he uses up, well, on that view, you could conceive of a loaf of bread as equal to bread minus flour, that's the baker's addition, plus flour minus wheat, the miller's addition, plus wheat. That's how you can think of a loaf of bread. You could say a loaf of bread is equal to the bread minus the flour, that's what the baker produced, plus the flour minus the wheat, that's what the miller produced, plus the wheat. And once you start thinking of things that way, then it becomes possible to get still further confused. We can formulate these 3 product differences in a variety of ways. We can have alternative formulations of bread equals bread minus flour plus flour minus wheat plus wheat. In formulation A, we can arrive at the obvious fact that bread equals bread. If we hold these 3 conceptual differences together, see, if we're holding bread minus flour, flour minus wheat, and wheat, if we keep them all glued together, as I've indicated by putting them inside parentheses and in italic type, then we view bread as bread. But now, let's reformulate these 3 product differences, these 3 conceptual elements. You see, what's going on here, contemporary economics is actually starting to conceive of bread, not as bread, but as being built out of 3 conceptual elements. Bread is the sum of the three conceptual elements, bread minus flour plus flour minus wheat plus wheat. If we keep them all glued together, bread is bread. Now let's begin to unglue them. In formulation B, let's view bread as equal to bread minus flour, which I now put on dim. I'm not going to hold it in the forefront of consciousness, and I indicate this by putting it in Roman type and taking it outside the parentheses. And now we're just going to keep glued together these two conceptual elements, flour minus wheat plus wheat. They're the elements inside the parentheses in italic type. Now, in that view, bread appears to equal flour plus fade out. In the third formulation, bread is viewed as bread minus flour plus flour minus wheat, both of which are put on dim and will show up as fade out. And what remains highlighted is wheat. Well, in this way, we've got bread conceived of as being bread, flour, and wheat. And it's exactly on this basis that contemporary economics arrives at the conclusion that when you count the value of the bread, you're counting the value of the wheat and the flour. Now, I quote at length Professor Reynolds in the excerpt from my book, which you have separately. Here, I'll give you a simple version and show you how contemporary economics arrives at this notion that the value of bread counts everything. I'll show you how it makes 6 count 14. 6 equals 1 plus 2 plus 3. All right, let 1 be the value added by the baker. Now, this is still in the lecture supplement on page 4. The lecture supplement on page 4. It's a simplified representation of Professor Reynolds' example that's dealt with separately in the excerpt. All right, 6 is equal to 1 plus 2 plus 3. We'll assume that 1 is the value added by the baker. 2 is the value added by the miller. 3 is the value added by the wheat farmer. The wheat farmer produces wheat, it's worth 3. The miller buys the wheat for 3. He produces flour. He sells the flour for 5. His value added is 2. The baker buys the flour for 5. He sells the bread for 6. His value added is 1. All right, well, 6 equals 1 plus 2 plus 3 combined in the parentheses. So 6, the value of the bread, counts the value of the bread. Now, 6 is also equal to 1 standing outside the parentheses plus 2 plus 3 in the parentheses. 2 plus 3 represent the value of the flour. It's in that sense, according to contemporary economics, that the bread counts the flour. And finally, 6 is equal to 1 plus 2 standing outside the parentheses plus 3 in the parentheses. And it's in that sense that the bread counts the value of the wheat. Now, if we look at these equations from the point of view of sound mathematics, these three equations are all saying the same thing. They're all expressing the value of the bread in three different ways. And in reality, all we have expressed here is the value of the bread. But what contemporary economics does is it feels free to let go parts of the equation. It feels free to let go the one in equation B, whatever is standing outside the parentheses, let that float off, and then let the 1 plus 2 in equation C float off, and then it adds the 3. And in its view, the value of the bread, 6, somehow ends up counting the 6 plus the 5 plus the 3. The 6 counts 14. Now, properly, what we have to say about these equations is that 6 is equal to 1 plus 2 plus 3 inside parentheses, or, and I'd like to write the word or in letters as high as this room, or, alternatively, it equals 1 outside parentheses plus 2 plus 3 in the parentheses, or, as another formulation, it equals 1 plus 2 outside and 3 inside. What it does not equal is 1 plus 2 plus 3 inside plus 2 plus 3 inside plus 3 inside. But contemporary economics views the bread as equaling the 3. It views 6 as being 14. It is double counting the bread. Contemporary economics double counts. It views the bread as more than itself. It thinks the bread is not only the bread, but also flour and wheat. In reality, on any formulation, mathematically or logically, the bread is simply and only the bread. Now, I call the view of contemporary economics, I describe it as a Platonic Heraclitian view of entities. I call it Platonic because it views entities as being constructed out of conceptual elements. It regards a loaf of bread not as a loaf of bread, a simple thing out there independently of us, but as the sum of 3 conceptual elements: bread minus flour plus flour minus wheat plus wheat. That's the Platonic element, thinking that concepts are the stuff of which entities are made. The Heraclitian element is the creation of a kaleidoscopic flux on top of this, because we simply rearrange these conceptual elements in different orders and we come up with different entities. You add the 3 together, you keep the 3 conceptual elements glued together, bread is bread. Let one of them float apart, bread becomes flour. Let 2 of them float apart, bread becomes wheat. So bread is bread, flour, and wheat. Now, these confusions of contemporary economics are supported, as I've indicated, by ideas widely prevalent among people in the street. And let's start with the question of what is bought when you buy it. My view is that the buyers of goods do not buy the means of producing the goods they buy, nor the means of producing similar goods in the future, nor the products that may be produced from those goods. When you buy something, you buy simply and only that which you receive from the seller, period. When you buy a loaf of bread, that's all you are buying. You're not buying the flour the baker bought, you're not paying the wages he paid, you're not buying the flour he will buy with the money he obtains from you, or the wages he will pay. You're not making his political or charitable contributions. You're buying simply and only the loaf of bread. You're also not buying a loaf of toast. You're not buying something into which you will make the item. These are all confusions that are held in one form or another by the great majority of people often. Now, any other view, and it's necessary to dwell on this, because the confusions are so immense. People have the idea that when you buy a loaf of bread, somehow you're buying the flour and the wheat, somehow you're paying for the labor. I want to go to great lengths to show you that you are not. And the best way to do it is by thinking of real situations in which you would buy these items. Imagine you're going shopping, you go down one aisle, you put a loaf of bread in your basket. You go down another aisle, you put a sack of flour in the basket. If they have a health food department, maybe you can also buy some wheat. And so now you go up to the checkout stand, they ring up 3 separate distinct items. This is a real, genuine purchase of bread, flour, and wheat. But if all that you buy is the loaf of bread, and that's all you pay for, and that's all you walk out of the store with, that is all you have bought. Any idea that in buying the loaf of bread, you've bought flour and wheat, this is a kind of shadow purchase. You don't get the flour and the wheat on top of the bread. All of them are in the same wrapper as the bread. You're just paying the one price, and best of all, it only has the same calories as the bread. You don't buy the flour or the wheat when you buy the bread any more than you eat the flour or the wheat. Now, there are people who think, yeah, but I am eating that flour. No, you are not. In reality, what it would mean to eat flour, you open a bag of flour, try a spoonful. If that doesn't do it for you, try tractor parts. Now, this notion that because something comes from something, the something from which it comes is in the thing, on that logic, if we started and we melted some snow or some ice, and then we boiled that water into steam, you could talk about the ice in the steam. There is no more flour or wheat in the bread than there is ice in the steam. The fact that something comes from something does not retain that form of something in the new product. Now also, let me point out that the very fact that the producers need capital is also a demonstration of the fact that the consumers are not buying the means of production. The fact that a company must have capital, it must have its own funds to advance, is itself a demonstration that the consumers don't buy the product, don't buy the means of production. If the consumers were in fact paying the wages, buying the materials and machinery and so forth, business firms would not need capital. Tomorrow morning, I could decide to go into the steel business without any capital, and when my suppliers ask me to be paid or my workers ask me to be paid, I would say, what do you mean? Haven't you read Professor Samuelson? It's the consumers who pay you. So bring your bills to them. Let me point out also that if in fact you buy the inputs, if in fact you buy the labor, the materials, and so forth, then you do not have to buy the output. You already own the output. If, for example, I employ a cook and I give her money to go shopping and so forth, and then she prepares a meal, I already own that meal. I do not sit down at my own table and am then presented with a check. When you buy the inputs, you do not have to buy the output. When you buy the output, it is precisely because you have not bought the inputs. All you buy is what you buy, period. Now, what this adds up to, as I state in the strongest possible way I can on page 5, when we reason in economics, what is absolutely vital is the need for the recognition of the full parity of existence of capital goods and of expenditure for capital goods and labor. We have to recognize capital goods as fully existing. Their existence is obliterated by contemporary economics. We have to recognize that they exist fully as much as consumer goods, that they're produced fully as much as consumer goods. We have to recognize that the expenditure to buy capital goods and to pay wages is fully as real as the expenditure to buy consumers' goods. And we must view all of these expenditures. We cannot limit ourselves just to viewing the consumption expenditure. Now, I think the results that follow from this change are immense, and I think it will stand as a good illustration of the necessity of keeping in mind the proposition that A is A. This is the world's most profoundly non-trivial redundancy. It serves to stop us from tripping over our own conceptual knowledge. When you forget the importance of recognizing that entities are things out there on their own, they're not built out of our minds, then when you forget that, the very existence of our conceptual knowledge can serve to confuse us. Ayn Rand stated in the Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, "It is axiomatic concepts that identify the precondition of knowledge, the distinction between existence and consciousness, between reality and the awareness of reality, between the object and the subject of cognition." Well, we want to recognize a loaf of bread is out there. We don't make it inside our heads. And the fact that we know it's connected with flour and wheat doesn't mean that the flour and wheat are in the bread. Let me observe that classical economics was implicitly Aristotelian. The major difference between classical and contemporary economics, in my judgment, was the fact that, at least by implication, the classical economists were operating on an Aristotelian concept of entities. And I have a lengthy quotation here from John Stuart Mill, who is the only economist explicitly to raise this issue by advancing the proposition, demand for commodities is not demand for labor. If you can read it, you might just read that first paragraph, and then later at your leisure, read the second one. Well, I think Mill's proposition should be reformulated. Instead of in the negative, demand for commodities is not demand for labor, it should be wider and positive, and simply be the demand for A is the demand for A, period. Now we're in a position to turn to the connection between what I describe as Aristotelian entities and the role of saving in spending. If you recognize that when you buy something, that's all you're buying, that when you buy A, you're only buying A, not the history or the future connections of A, but just A itself, then it becomes clear that all that the consumers are buying are consumer goods. The only thing that consumers buy in the economic system are consumer goods. If you buy a loaf of bread, that's all that you're buying. If you buy an automobile, that's all that you're buying. All other spending in the economic system is made by business firms. All the spending for capital goods, all the spending for goods at wholesale, all the spending for machinery, equipment, materials, components, and supplies, all the wage payments of business firms, they are made by business firms out of capital. They represent productive expenditure. They are expenditures made for the purpose of making subsequent sales. They are not paid by the consumers. Consumption expenditures, in contrast, are expenditures made not for the purpose of making subsequent sales. This is something I go into in the last series of lectures at TJS, which you could hear on tape if you wish. Productive expenditure depends on saving. It depends on the portion of revenues and incomes that people earn that they do not consume. Only by not consuming these revenues and incomes can they productively expend them. To To the extent that people consume more of their revenues and incomes and save less, their ability to make productive expenditures is less. If everyone did nothing but consume, there would be no productive expenditure. Now let's imagine you go somewhere to a nearby store, you spend $100 in buying consumers' goods. Well, so far, all there is $100 of consumer expenditure. Suppose the owner of that store now takes your $100 and he turns around and consumes that $100. He goes to some other store and buys another $100 of consumer goods. You've gone over to La Jolla Village Square. They have a Ralph's supermarket. You've bought $100 worth of groceries. The owner of Ralph's comes in. He takes that $100 out of the cash register. He goes across the square to Stroud's linen store and buys $100 worth of towels. The owner of Stroud's takes the $100 he collects from selling the towels. He goes to TGI Fridays and has a blast. All right. Now, what is present here is only consumer spending. There is no other spending but consumer spending going on. And the only possible additional income that could be associated with this spending is profit. What we have is additional sales revenue at each stage. The different businesses are ringing up additional dollars of sales revenue as we go from step to step. The only income that could be represented by the additional sales revenue is profit of the stores. There are no wages being paid here at all. There's no purchase of goods at wholesale. There's no purchase of replacement supplies. There's no purchase of fixtures, of equipment. All there are purchases of the consumer goods. So the only income that could be raised is profit. Now, what would be required? What is required so that when you go into a store and you buy $100 worth of consumer goods, what has to happen so that as a subsequent result, there will be some demand for labor, for goods at wholesale, for materials, equipment, etc.? What must the sellers do with their proceeds in order for such a demand to arise? They have to not consume those proceeds. If Ralph's does not consume the $100, if Ralph's consumes $1 out of $100 and uses $99 to buy groceries at wholesale, then there's a $99 demand for groceries at wholesale. But that $99 of demand at wholesale depends on Ralph's not consuming the $99. Ralph's has to save the $99. All demand for goods at wholesale, the demand for materials, machinery, the payment of wages, all of this depends on saving, on what is not consumed. If all that we had is consumption, we'd have sales revenues, we wouldn't have any of the other expenditures. The only income that could exist would be profit, not wages. There would be no demand for capital goods. Let me apply this immediately to my favorite economist, Paul Samuelson. At the back of the excerpt, on the very last page, on the inside, it's really page 33, I have reproduced a page of Samuelson's textbook under the Fair Use Doctrine. It's on the inside. And you might just read the bottom passage on the left, in the left column, titled Woodsheds and Carpenters. And this is on the multiplier doctrine. And also, the final paragraph over on the right above his footnote. Now notice, do you need more time? Notice Samuelson proceeds as though all you need is consumer spending. He has successive rounds of consumption expenditure, and he thinks this represents a rise in demand throughout the whole economy. He thinks this is the means of achieving full employment. And he even ends by saying, the greater the extra consumption respending, the greater the multiplier, the better things are. The greater the MPS leakage, MPS means marginal propensity to save. To whatever extent the extra spending is being saved at each round, the smaller the final multiplier. In Samuelson's view, to the extent the sellers save their revenues and incomes, that's the end. There is no further demand. All demand is contained in consumer demand. Well, Samuelson comes to that conclusion, and the rest of contemporary economics. They believe that when you buy the bread, you're buying the flour and the wheat and paying the wages, because in their view, the bread is a kind of blur that represents all of these things. And when you buy the bread, you're buying everything. Well, in reality, everything depends on saving and productive expenditure. Now, in the 2 or 3 or 5 minutes remaining, largely for the benefit of those of you who've had some economics courses or will have, I'd like to try to reconcile my approach to with national income accounting. In contemporary economics, national income represents the sum, basically, of profit and wages. National income is profit and wages. And it is taught that national income is equal to the sum of consumer spending plus net investment. Now, that is a true equality. It is true, but it is totally misinterpreted. In contemporary economics, it's thought almost all of the spending is under the heading of consumption. For example, if national income were 1,000, consumption would probably be in the neighborhood of 900 and net investment 100. As contemporary economics sees things, 900 of total spending is consumption. There's a piddling 100 included under net investment. In reality, most of the spending is hidden under net investment. And what I attempt to do on page seven, is indicate how and why that is so. In my view, if we were looking at total spending, what we'd want to look at, or total revenues, we'd want to look at business sales revenues. Business sales revenues. And that I simply call S. And then there are business sales revenues that are paid by other businesses. For example, when U.S. Steel sells steel to General Motors, from the perspective of General Motors, that's a productive expenditure. So S sub B is that part of aggregate business sales revenues paid by business firms and constituting part of productive expenditure. S sub C is that part of aggregate business sales revenues paid by consumers and constituting part of consumption expenditure. And then we have wages, broken down in the same way. The great bulk of wages are paid by business firms, W sub B. The only wages paid by consumers are those of domestic servants and government employees. That's W sub C. If we add the sales revenues and the wages together, if we have S plus W, well, we have total revenue and income. If we add them from the perspective of the type of spending, if we add the sales revenues that are consumption and the wages that are consumption, well, that's consumption. If we add the sales revenues that are paid by business and the wages that are paid by business, that's total productive expenditure, which I label B. Total revenue is consumption plus productive expenditure. If we take away costs from sales revenue, we have profit. And the left side of A on the middle of page 7, if we took away costs from S, the left side would reduce to profit plus wages. That would be national income. If we took away costs from productive spending, it reduces to net investment. Most spending goes on under, is concealed under net investment, which is like the visible portion of an iceberg. Contemporary national income accounting has a correct relationship, but as I say, it's totally misinterpreted in thinking that most of the spending goes on under consumption. This is an aspect that's a little bit technical, but for those of you who are in economics or are planning to take a course, I thought it would be helpful for you to see how my approach fits with national income accounting. All right, well, I've covered a good deal of ground, as much as I had hoped to today. I don't think I've omitted anything crucial. So I think it's time, perhaps, to turn the floor open to questions. Thank you. And Mr. Coates? Well, insofar as they recognize that we need to save, that would be consistent with what? Pardon? Okay. The question is, how do I reconcile contemporary economist statements about the need to save more? Japan is saving heavily, we're not saving so heavily, and many economists recognize this. Now, if you're asking how I reconcile that with their views, that's the difficulty. I have no problem reconciling that with my views, but from the point of view of their views, they have a problem. And even when they recognize the role of saving, and there are some economists who are quite good and who do appreciate the role of saving, they do not see it as importantly as the classical economists saw it. I'm sure that many of you own Henry Hazlitt's The Failure of the New Economics. All right, you might look up John Stuart Mill in the index. Hazlitt quotes a substantial portion of the passage from Mill that I've quoted. And in fact, that's how I became aware of that passage, reading it in Hazlitt. And when he discusses it, he agrees with Mill on the importance of saving, but even he did not see at that time that saving is the source of all the demand in the economy, just about. He sees that saving is important for machinery, but he didn't see that saving is the base of the demand for labor and everything else other than simply consumers' goods. So you can have a view that of saving that is good as far as it goes, but the best of contemporary economists don't carry the view far enough. If you don't recognize that wages are paid by productive expenditure, which depends on saving, that's not appreciating the full importance of saving. Yes, Mr. Terza.
Yes, under the contemporary economist view, only the product addition is produced, the product less the goods used up in producing.
Yes.
And how, under their view, does the consumer buy the product plus the goods used in producing it? Don't they have the purchaser buying more than what is being produced? That would say, if you buy the loaf of bread plus the flour and the wheat, and under their view, when you produce them, if you're only producing, say, the loaf of bread less than what is used up in producing, it just seems like a contradiction. You're only producing the loaf of, you're only producing the incremental amount.
Yes.
When you buy it, you're buying each independently the bread plus the flour plus the wheat.
Yes, the notion that you're only, the question is, if you're only producing the incremental amount, how does one end up with the idea that you're buying the full collection of entities? Well, I think that results from the confusion of viewing the final product as a collection of conceptual elements, as a collection of increments. If you view the bread as bread minus flour plus flour minus wheat, etc., that sets you up for viewing the bread as bread, flour, and wheat. Because you then just drop from consciousness the component bread minus flour, and now the bread appears as flour. Or then drop another component and it appears as wheat. You can't expect consistency when you start off, I don't mean you, but when one starts off with the idea that the producers aren't producing their products, that the product is made of a bundle of abstractions, and then you end up thinking that you buy the whole thing. Now, many people have this idea without viewing production as consisting of the increments. There are countless people who believe when you buy the bread, you're buying the flour or the wheat. This gentleman back here?
Yes, what is the implication of contemporary economics in relation to the accounting profession today? What effect is it having on the way they evaluate business, the viability of businesses, and even a country's finances?
I don't think contemporary economics has very much effect on accounting. They tend to look at accountants as being backward. And this comes up. No one is asking accountants to change their accounting in connection with the value-added idea, but it would come up more in connection with the doctrine of imputed income and opportunity cost. But the accountants don't listen, and you'll find that they're repeatedly criticized. This is something I went into at the last TJS in one of the opening lectures. This gentleman in the back over here.
Yes.
The thought occurred to me, I was wondering if contemporary economic view has any connection with the Marxist view. If you add in the concept of the cost of labor could be treated conceptually as equal to the cost of, let's say, material good as just a general cost, that supports the Marxist view that somehow the end product value is going to be determined partially or fully by the cost of the labor that went into something, and whereas in fact, it may not be the case at all. You may put $100 into labor to something that nobody would want to buy for $10.
The question is, does the contemporary view have any connection with the doctrines of Marxism? And the question raises the issue, would it be along the lines that you buy the product and somehow the product is solidly the labor that produces it. I don't think that's the connection. I think that viewing the consumers as buying more than they're buying, I think that notion makes Marxism possible in an important respect. For example, Adam Smith and Marx advanced the argument that if there were no capitalists, if we lived in a world where manual laborers were producing and selling commodities and turned around and consumed the whole sales proceeds, in that environment, there'd be no exploitation of labor, all income would be wages, nothing would be profit. The reality is, if you recognize that all the consumers buy are consumers' goods, in those circumstances, all income would be profit, no income would be wages. This is a subject I dealt with in the last TJS conference, which is on tape and available from Second Renaissance Book Service. All the consumers buy are consumer goods. If there are no businessmen or capitalists, there are sales revenues from the consumer goods. There's no productive expenditure. There are no money costs of production. All the sales revenues represent profit. There's an indirect connection with Marxism. If you grasp that the consumers buy only what they buy, that's the end of Marxism.
I
know you're coming at it from a different perspective, but I'm just answering you at the level of a connection to Marxism. In the back, the lady in the yellow top.
Would there be a logical connection?
I'm sorry?
Would there be a logical connection with the economist saying that the consumer owns everything that went into production with a severing of the ownership rights of the producers? That was if the person who bought the loaf of bread owned the flour, the wheat, the fertilizer, part of the tractor, yeah, would that then be part of their way of diluting the ownership of the manufacturers and the producers and saying that if you are a consumer, you have bought part of the
I'm not quite sure I understand your point. You're saying, are they viewing the consumer as owning the means of production?
Right.
They're viewing the consumer as buying the means of production. Now, in reality, if the consumer were the owner, he wouldn't buy them. Now, they do view the consumer as buying the means of production. They view the consumer as buying the means that have been used in the past to make what you buy today, the means that will be purchased in the future to make similar consumer goods then. They view consumers as financing research and development outlays, as paying for advertising, as supporting political contributions. There's a confusion. You take any two things that are causally connected or stand in a sequence, and they can be run together as part of one package. Yes, Mr. Hattab.
What if they wanted to revise that and say you're not buying the means of production, but you're actually employing it as a rentor?
Well, I mean, you're employing it as a rentor?
Yes, you're renting the means of production, the tractor, the farmer's land, the baker's ovens, and you're paying them, returning the rent to them in the form of their profit. Is that a modified thing that you would accept?
The question is, what if they reformulated the view to say instead of buying, you were renting? I would say that's exactly the same position. To rent something is to buy the use of a thing. Now, when I go into a store, that store may be renting its premises. In no sense am I paying the store's rent. I'm simply buying what I buy. If I were in fact paying the store's rent and were an owner of the store, I wouldn't have to buy the items. I'd already own them. All you're buying is what you're buying. Yes, this gentleman.
Yes, then how would you calculate gross national product then? Is this your formula for gross national product, or is it the summation of all capital expenditures in the economy?
And how would I calculate gross national product? Well, you see, I don't believe that production can actually be measured by money. What the volume of money that is spent under the heading gross national product or any other such measure actually measures is not the physical production of goods, but the quantity of money. If we, the only way we get a larger monetary gross national product is on the basis of more money. Now, if you ask, what would I suggest as an accounting replacement for the concept of gross national product, I would give it the name gross national revenue, and I express it on page 7. It's the sum of business sales revenues plus wage payments, and it's constituted by consumption expenditure plus productive expenditure. Now, I don't attach any particular importance to that. I just present this concept to show how I would interpret contemporary national income accounting, how my system could tie to it. But I don't think this measures anything. The importance of this would be when we think of spending and revenue, we should not be thinking merely of consumer spending or net investment. We should be thinking of the spending that goes on that constitutes sales revenues and incomes at all stages. We should be thinking of the sum of spending for not just consumer goods, but goods at wholesale, all of the materials, the equipment, and all of the wage payments. And that I would call gross national revenue. Yes, this gentleman in the center here. Yeah.
You said that when you buy bread, you don't physically buy bread and flour and wheat.
Right.
And that's, you know, I understand that. Would you say that the price you pay for the bread contains information about the price of the flour, the price of the wheat, and the milling costs, and the production that was necessary to produce the bread?
I would say there is a connection between the price of bread and the prices that constitute the cost of producing the bread. But when you pay the price of bread, you're not paying those prices. You're just paying the price of bread. Over, yes, the gentleman in the blue shirt. Oh, that's Dr. Binswanger.
You made a rather startling statement just in the answer to the previous one. I want to see if I understood it. You said that the gross national product measures the monetary relationship, not the production. Does that mean that when the gross national product goes up, we're simply seeing inflation and we should be disappointed to the extent that it goes up, or does that not follow?
Now the question is, since gross national product reflects the quantity of money, when we see GNP go up, should we be disappointed on the grounds that it just represents inflation? I wouldn't quite say that. Gross national product does represent just the growth in the quantity of money. Under a gold standard, there would be some growth in the quantity of money, depending on the growth in gold mining. The rise in money gross national product would reflect the increase in the quantity of gold. At the same time, there would be increases in production. But what we would welcome is the increase in production. The money aspect is not the critical thing. Now, on a fiat money system such as we have, the only significance of gross national product is that it represents more money. We should think, the basic way of thinking of more production, the effect of more production is always to work to reduce prices. And this will tie in with the concept of an invariable money. With a gold standard, if we have rising production, we'll have more production of goods. At the same time, there'll be some additional production of gold. But they're related, yet distinct processes. There is no precision of any kind, even under a gold standard, in saying that because the gross national product is now 1.1 trillion ounces rather than 1 trillion ounces, that this represents anything. The young lady on the far right here? Yes.
I'm
in the back of you. I'll get to you in a moment. Yes.
Do economists, is there gain to this idea about bread versus flour and wheat altogether, do they mean to lower the value of the bread itself? Do they mean to lower the value of everything?
Do they need to lower the value?
Yes, to say that it's not worth what it's really worth.
No, I don't see any implication of lowering the value. The implication, which they would not be consciously aware. I'm sorry. There's a question. When economists follow this line that I call the Platonic-Heraclitian view of entities, is there any desire to lower the value of the final product? No, they don't have that as any kind of motivation. If anything, the implication is you're buying much more. The implication is, think how much a dollar buys. You buy a loaf of bread, and not only do you have the loaf of bread, you have the flour and the wheat. And then you have everything that the seller buys with the dollar. There is no logic to it. It's the denial of logic. If someone is on the premise that a thing is more than itself, you cannot expect logical consistency. The young lady over here, yeah.
I was wondering, when they determine the actual price to charge the consumer, do they break it down into the bread, flour, and the wheat, and add those prices together?
The question is, when they decide the price to charge the consumer, do they break it down into the flour and the wheat and add those together? Who? Well, they don't charge prices for bread. They don't determine the system of how to price things. Things are priced in the market. In their view, when you pay the market price of something, you are somehow not only buying the thing you're buying, but the whole banana that stands behind it. See, this is an issue of how one understands what goes on in the market. They're not in a position to determine the market, but it's their conception of what is happening. The baking companies are producing bread. The buyers of bread are buying bread. That's the reality. But economists attempting to understand all of this are confused to the point of believing that the baking companies are not producing bread, they're producing bread minus flour, that the millers are producing part of the bread that the bakers don't produce, that the buyers are buying not just the bread, but the flour and everything else. It's a confusion of the thought of those who are trying to understand. Mr. Altenberg.
Is there a proposition in contemporary economics that would be the equivalent of the end product produced by the productive process is qualitatively and quantitatively different from the sum of its parts?
You might come across that.
That sort of stem of the Heraclitian river a little?
I really don't know. But the Heraclitian river is there. That is the essential thing. The gentleman in the far back, Mr. Dunn.
Is it feasible to have any generalized index of production as opposed to the index of revenue? Now get a gross national product figure, but is there any way to have an index of productivity generalized as opposed to through rail car loadings or tons of steel or whatever?
Is there any way to have an index of production apart from a monetary index of gross national product? You could have some kind of index, but the point is, it's a mistake to think that any measure, even if we recognize that more money just comes from more money, no measure can be precise. And in the reality of it is, we could say there has been a modest increase in production, a significant increase, a large increase, a very large increase, an enormous increase. That we're able to do in a practical way by looking at what is the standard of living, what is being produced, but it is really not possible to say with any legitimacy production in the last month is up 0.1%, or to adjust monetary statistics by means of a price index. This is a fictitious idea of precision. And I say a little bit about this in the excerpt that I've given you from the draft of my book called money not a measure of GNP? And I go into the problem of price indices. This gentleman over here.
The contemporary view seems so fantastic. What they're saying is that when you buy when you pay $6 for a loaf of bread, you're actually getting $14 worth of commodities. Is that what it comes down to?
Now, do they say, the question is, do contemporary economists say, when you spend $6 in buying bread, are you taking home $14 worth of goods? No, they don't go that far. They're not in an asylum. The implications of their idea is that they believe that when you spend $6 for bread or whatever, and you simply walk out with the $6 worth of bread, that somehow inside the same wrapper is the flour and the wheat. They think that when you buy the bread, in the bread is the flour and the wheat. Now, I contrast that with a real purchase of bread, flour, and wheat. They don't claim, I hope, that the purchase of an actual loaf of bread is in reality the purchase of wheat and flour as well. I call them shadow purchases. And I would say that's why we have to disregard them. But contemporary economics believes that when you count that $6, you don't have to count the other eight. You've already counted the eight when you count the six. For example, Professor Samuelson says GNP is the total product of the economy for a year. It's measured by the flow of final product. Now, sometimes you find bizarre, openly bizarre statements, which give away the view of entities. Let me quote you Professor Bach and Alchin and Allen. Professor Bach, who has a prominent textbook, says, for example, in converting the iron ore to steel above, Bethlehem adds something to the value of the product it passes along. In converting the iron ore to the steel, Bethlehem adds something to the value of the product it passes along. It's supposedly passing along iron ore. Alchin and Allen say, for example, most steel bought from U.S. Steel by General Motors is not at that time bought by the final user. For General Motors later resells the steel as an automobile. Now, their view is the final product is itself and everything else. An automobile is the automobile, the steel sheet, and the iron ore. The bread, flour, and wheat. The final product is everything. They're in a position where if my assignment to myself was count the audience in this room, and then somehow I came to the conclusion that all I had to do was count the people in the first row, and that each person in the first row counted all the rows behind him, that they all blended into him. And therefore, I'd be committing an error if I went out to count the entire audience. That's the position they're in. You see, here I am. I want to conceive the economic world. I want to look at the economic world. I have to have a conception of how big is it? What is it? Contemporary economics thinks that the totality of the economic world is contained in the front row. It's contained in the consumer goods, and that it is therefore a positive error, the error of double counting, to look beyond the first row and count that in addition. My view is total spending has to count the spending to buy the automobile plus the spending to buy the steel plus the spending to buy the iron ore. The total production is the production of the automobiles, the steel, and the iron ore, and similarly with bread. And a proper view of economics should look at it all. Contemporary economics says that's an error. It's the error of double counting. Everything is counted when we count the production of the consumer goods and when we buy the consumer goods. Contemporary economics is an economics of consumption. Yes, this gentleman in the blue shirt.
But if nobody pays any attention to these people, you say the accountants don't pay any attention to the farmers. Bakers pay no attention to millers. What harm is this
I haven't said that nobody, the question is, what harm does this do if nobody pays attention? I've said that the accountants don't pay attention. The farmers and millers are going about their business without paying attention. But who does pay attention? Economic policymakers pay attention. And it's on the basis of this view that contemporary economics is able, has been able for generations to totally shunt saving aside. If you look at that quotation from Samuelson, in Samuelson's view, to the extent that people save, they're aborting the income stream. That all that counts for spending and employment is consumption. Now, on that view, you have economic policy developed, which is very hostile to saving. Now, what are the consequences? The consequences are turning the United States economy from the world's most rapidly progressing economy to into a stagnant or declining economy. That's the major consequence. Then there are further consequences. I shouldn't even say that's the major consequence. That's a very important consequence. The major consequences are in preventing a clear conception of what goes on in the economic world. See, it makes an enormous difference if there are people who are trying to study the economic world who think that an automobile is a pile of iron ore. That when we drive an automobile, we're in some sense driving the iron ore or the steel sheet. Because then they cannot think about the economic world properly. This sort of view allows Marxism to pass without the kind of challenge it should have. It allows all kinds of errors to exist about the issues that I raised in the description of my lectures. I'm trying to sweep this wrong view out of the way. I've indicated my own view, and tomorrow we'll go into my view further and we'll see what the implications of an Aristotelian-based approach to economics are. Bill?
Is there a connection here with the idea of value, and that value is, you and I would call value, is subjective, and they're trying to make it an object thing. They're trying to set value objectively using an accounting method to support that false premise.
You're saying, is there a problem that they are regarding value as objective when in fact it's subjective? No, I don't think that is the problem, and I don't believe that value is subjective in the sense that you mean it. You're raising further issues. Value is personal. It depends on personal context. If you're talking about marginal utility, the problem of contemporary economics, I would say, is they have a radically subjective view of value, a subjective view of entities. They're confusing ideas in their minds with physical entities out there in the world. Objectively, the baking company produces bread. Objectively, that's all you buy. It's an internal subjective mishmash to believe that what's being produced is a product addition, that what's being bought is a series of abstractions that can be added in different fashions to make different things. This will have to be the last question. We have to make way for the next speaker, the gentleman in the turquoise shirt.
Regarding Samuelson's multiplier, what would Samuelson say if, after building the woodshed, the carpenter, instead of taking the $1,000 and spending $667, went out and instead spent $2,000? Have a very nice multiplier in that case, and I was wondering how Samuelson would respond to that.
Well, he'd say, then that's fine. He even has a case like that where you have a super multiplier, but let's even imagine that. Suppose you spend $1,000 to buy a woodshed, the seller is so happy he now spends $2,000 to buy a car, and the seller of the automobile spends $4,000 to buy a motorboat, and on and on. All right? You have a lot of demand for consumer goods here. Where is there any demand for labor services or materials, equipment, supplies, whatever? There still is none. That's the essential point. Well, I think we have to draw a line here. And tomorrow, we'll continue with the development of my own positive view. Thank you.